From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
They want justice in East Timor. They need maybe a security council to provide, international tribunal for East Timor to, make some process about the war crimes, crimes against humanity done, and genocide in East Timor.
On this first anniversary of its vote for independence, the people of East Timor mourn their past and celebrate their future. We'll go to Dili. Also, U.S. aid or Colombian blood. Just days after two paramilitary massacres there, President Clinton heads to Colombia to promote a $1 billion aid package. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Late yesterday, Lori Berenson was moved to a prison in Lima, Peru. As the Peruvian dictator Alberto Fujimori said yesterday that a military court was obligated to revoke her life prison sentence and grant a civilian trial because of evidence suggesting she was not a leader of the Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement. Berenson is the American activist who's been imprisoned in Peru for nearly 5 years, serving a life sentence for treason against the fatherland. Though Berenson's sentence was voided earlier this week, Fujimori and even Berenson's Peruvian lawyer are saying she should be tried on lesser charges that still carry 20-year-to-life sentences. She will remain in jail through her so-called civilian trial. Her parents are demanding she be released immediately. Berenson denies all charges against her. East Timor marked the first anniversary of its historic independence vote today with tearful prayers for those killed by the Indonesian military in the long fight for independence and calls for a war crimes tribunal for those responsible. Thousands of people walked or rode in UN trucks and motorbikes to a cathedral in Dili, East Timor's capital, to give thanks for their freedom. Thousands gathered also at Dili's Santa Cruz Cemetery, the scene of the 1991 massacre in which more than 270 Timorese were gunned down by the Indonesian military. We'll go to Dili, East Timor, in just a few minutes. Meanwhile, this news from Jakarta. Indonesia will clamp tight security around the venue of former dictator Suharto's trial on graft charges tomorrow, as students say they will ignore calls not to protest against the dictator. Jakarta police spokesman told Reuters that some 1,200 police would ring the site of the landmark trial. Suharto will be tried at the government complex in the city's south instead of a standard courtroom because of space and security. He has been charged with corruption and could face up to life in jail for the suspected misuse of up to $500 million from seven charities he controlled while in power. Meanwhile, activists in Indonesia and the people of East Timor are calling on him to be tried for crimes against humanity. The Miami Herald is reporting today that the Pentagon plans to send an army general to Bogota to oversee part of its $1.3 billion Colombian anti-drug aid package. Brigadier General Keith Huber, director of operations at the U.S. Southern Command in Miami, will implement the military portion of the plan. Huber, a one-star general with a 25-year career in the Army and background in special forces, was appointed by Marine General Charles Wilhelm. The U.S. aid package will go primarily to the Colombian military. It includes funds for 60 combat helicopters and military training. President Clinton travels to Cartagena today to deliver the aid package. More on this later in the program. U.S. officials said sonar tapes recorded by the American submarine USS Memphis support the theory that a faulty torpedo exercise sunk the Russian sub Kursk. According to senior intelligence and Navy officials, the Memphis captured sounds of two explosions, which they believe resulted from a torpedo misfiring and later an explosion of the torpedo's warhead. And in a ruling that could deal a blow to the Ford Motor Company, a California judge largely agreed late yesterday with complaints that Ford knowingly installed defective ignition mechanisms in nearly 2 million vehicles produced from 1983 to 1995. In a preliminary decision, Michael Balachi, a Superior Court judge in Alameda County, east of San Francisco, said he intends to issue orders, quote, compelling recall and repair of the vehicles. The final decision, which will be discussed at a hearing at the Alameda County Court on September 28th, could be more damaging to Ford's reputation than its finances, this according to consumer activists. In the wake of the Firestone tire recall, the company is working diligently to maintain public trust in its products. The judge said in his ruling, Ford withheld responsive information from the NHTSA that it was obligated to divulge. The sounds of East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country as President Clinton is in Colombia and the situation in East Timor continues and the celebration to present problems in Indonesia in general to the world community.
That's right. And we're going to be going to talk about Colombia at the end of the program. But right now, we take a look at this historic day. 1 year ago today, in a historic referendum, the people of East Timor voted to be free, voting an end to a quarter of a century occupation in which the Indonesian military killed one-third of the population, or 200,000 people. As the military razed the country, destroying 80% of the housing stock last year and driving hundreds of thousands of Timorese from their homes, many of them still being held today in West Timor, the Timorese went to the polls on August 30th, 1999. Last night, which is today in East Timor, we called through to a cell phone of a filmmaker who is standing in the Santa Cruz Cemetery, where thousands had gathered to remember the 1991 massacre in which Indonesian military gunned down more than 250 Timorese. Max Stahl was there inside the cemetery as he stood between tombstones, filming the people trying to escape the Indonesian military's gunfire. As the ceremonies began today in East Timor, Max Stahl described what he was looking at.
We're in the cemetery here in Santa Cruz, where this massacre took place just 9 years ago, and it's full of people. There's been thousands of people in the cathedral, and they walked, you know, in a long procession towards the cemetery, slightly reminiscent of that day. And this time there are more different sorts of soldiers, you know, UN soldiers, and friendly faces, and some people from the Australian government, the foreign minister here, and José Ramosorta and all those who were in the bush before. And they're all here. And I'm looking at the place where I sat 9 years ago and buried this film. That's about it, really. Sorry.
What are people saying there now?
Well, it's a kind of a ceremony, you know. There's been a little brief moment here with the dignitaries and people looking on, just because it's, you know, it is the the Independence Day. It's the day of the vote. And, of course, that's what these people died for. So although it's not the anniversary of the killing, it is the, you know, the key day, and people from all over the world have come here today, especially those who work for this. You know, many of those who worked in the solidarity movements are here. And families also, those people who died.
9 years ago, what were you looking at as you were inside the cemetery filming?
Well, I'm standing on the path now where I was sitting about away from where I am now, and what I was looking at was mayhem, you know. I believe you were outside in the road there somewhere. What I was looking at was hundreds of people trying to squeeze through a gate about 2-3 yards wide or less, crawling over each other, piling over each other. Some of them were wounded. Some of them were dead. Some of them were trying to clamber over the others and squeezing into this cemetery to get escape the bullets that were being fired down the street outside there. And when they got inside the cemetery, they ran for it. In fact, they ran for it. They mowed me down, quite literally, because I was filming them. And they kept on running until they got to the back, and they jumped over the walls until the troops and the soldiers came around and cut them off. And then they were trapped in there. Since I wasn't running, I was also trapped with them. Gradually, they moved in from the outside, grabbing the people and beating the wounded people. They stabbed a lot of people who were wounded. There was one guy next to me who'd been stabbed 5 times. And then gradually, they put them onto trucks, took them away from here. Most of them we never saw again. Some of them were taken to the hospital and treated. Others were taken to the hospital and poisoned or finished off with large stones that were there where they were building part of the morgue. Others, again, were taken away to a police station where I myself was taken, and some of them apparently were shot, about 100 of those, a day or two later.
Max,
it's become a place of. I'm now looking at the soldiers from the Falentin, those who never had the chance to be here at that time, but they are now in uniform, and they've come here to pay their respects as well.
These are the Timorese soldiers.
These are Timorese soldiers, yes. A few of them may possibly have been survivors of this, and because I met some of the Falentil in the mountains who had survived this, and they went to join the guerrillas afterwards. Of course, it provided it left them little alternative, those people who wanted to have a peaceful resolution here didn't see one possible after that, and so the armed struggle was renewed in its intensity as a result of this event.
Max, you were there a year ago when the vote took place, and now you're there today. What was it like a year ago?
Well, it was amazing. I was just talking to the Australian Foreign Minister, and I was doing something I never thought I would to an Australian Foreign Minister on the subject of Timor, and I was thanking him because until the Australian troops arrived here that day, this place was kind of a hell, and nobody knew what was going to happen. Anything was possible. There was burning. The whole city was a kind of shooting gallery with fires going off everywhere. The population were up here on the hills above me where I was with them, those who hadn't been forcibly shipped off in trucks to East Timor to camps where many of them still are in terror of the militia who control those camps. And the people in the hills, you know, had spears and bows and arrows and just about nothing else. We were watching these armed soldiers and militia who were working with them to systematically destroy the country. I believe they ended up destroying about 80% of the of the housing stock. It was an extraordinary piece of organized vandalism, but we didn't know when we were sitting there on the hills whether it was going to end up in a massacre or a slaughter, like it did. This happened in 1975. There were people up there with me who'd witnessed that, who said it was just the same. You know, they were watching their ships coming into the harbor, they were pointing down to the fires in the city, and they were saying, now, next thing you know, you're watching this, these ships are going to start shelling us here in the mountains. And then it changed. It changed really when the soldiers came in. You know, that was the moment it changed. Until that, you know, it was difficult to know what the hell was going on. And the international soldiers was the moment when we knew that the situation was really changing. Even then, it was a bit dodgy for a while. That was the key.
Hasn't the Australian government arrested you or barred you from entering Australia because you've used different names or passports?
Yes, ironically, yes. I've been barred from Australia now for several years, and the reason, and they still barred me. In fact, they didn't even let me leave East Timor via Australia, which was the only way to leave after this mayhem last year. The reason was because I was on the wanted list here in Indonesia, here in Timor and in Indonesia, for the Indonesian military, after filming this massacre and another film I made thereafter. And this was meant I was on a blacklist, and I was in considerable. I couldn't come here on my legal passport, obviously, and I had been offered one by a friendly government. In order, with the help of the resistance, had asked them to do it, and they'd done it as a gesture of solidarity. But in order to be able to leave East Timor, I also needed a visa to get on the aeroplane on that passport. Although I had a perfectly legal visa to enter Australia, I then had to seek a visa on this passport as well in order just to leave the country, leave Indonesia for Australia. And this event was discovered for reasons I won't bore you with, but the Australian bureaucracy, although they understood plainly what took place, decided rather perversely to put me in the bag with bank robbers and drug dealers, and on the basis they said that they didn't know who I really was. Since they said at the very same time that they'd had representations from senior Australian journalists, MPs, the Prime Minister of the Northern Territory, and various other people about me, I found that a little bit incredible. But they have stuck with that particular version ever since, and you know, questioning, as they put it, my bona fides. I have to say that, in this respect, I don't think it's my bona fides that are in question, but that's my opinion.
Max Stahl, we hear that today on this Independence Day, the 1 year after the vote, that there is a kind of contra war developing on the border with West Timor. What's happening?
Well, the small units of soldiers, uniformed soldiers, militia apparently, that's to say Timorese, but we don't really know who they are, whether they're Indonesians or Timorese, have been entering, crossing the border, infiltrating, and they have made a number of attacks on peacekeeping forces. They've killed a New Zealander, they killed a Nepalese soldier and wounded three more. They have reached as far as 150 kilometers or 100 kilometers at least, anyway, inside the border. There is apparently one group of them now in some form apparently surrounded by Portuguese soldiers, or at least identified by them in the central area of the country. And there is a kind of a standoff there at the present between these militia, who haven't yet killed anybody in this case, and the Portuguese soldiers. They don't have any support whatsoever in this country, as you would expect, since they just torched the whole place. And it's very difficult to see what they expect to achieve here, except to destabilize and further impoverish this already impoverished country.
Max Stahl, speaking to us from the Santa Cruz Cemetery in Dili, East Timor. as thousands of people gathered there earlier today for the beginning of day-long remembrance of the people who have died in Timor under the military occupation of a quarter of a century, and the people who are now rebuilding their country after last year's historic vote for independence by the people of East Timor. Today is the first anniversary. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Max Stahl, a British filmmaker who was in the cemetery in 1991 when the Santa Cruz massacre took place as he filmed the Timorese running from the Indonesian military gunfire. When we return, we'll talk to the man who organized the procession of Timorese that the Indonesian military fired on. Constancio Pinto will join us from Dili, East Timor. And we'll be joined by journalist and activist Alan Nairn, who survived the massacre, who was there last year at this time for the vote and is now in Asia. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we go now to the island of East Timor, which is marking the first anniversary of its historic independence vote today, with tearful prayers for those killed by the Indonesian military in the long fight for independence and calls for a war crimes tribunal for those responsible. On the island now in Dili is Constancio Pinto. Constancio is a resistance leader who co-chaired the umbrella party of resistance groups that's now laying the groundwork for an independent Timor. Meetings have been taking place until today of the CNRT, which is led by Xanana Gusmão and José Ramos Horta. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Constancio.
Thank you.
It's remarkable to hear your voice in Dili, East Timor. East Timor, which you fled from in 1991 after organizing the procession that the Indonesian military fired on. What are your thoughts today?
Well, I'm very happy to see, to celebrate the first anniversary of the historic referendum, which bring us to independence of East Timor and free from the Indonesian repression of the 24 years. And I'm very happy to see that despite the destructions and the exodus into West Timor, where we still have about 100,000 refugees in West Timor, people here are very happy celebrating this day, this historic day. This morning I went to the Untayet headquarters. A lot of people gathering, listening to
Untayet being the United Nations headquarters.
Yes, listening to the distinguished leaders here, including the UN, administration's chief, Sergio de Mello, and some special guests. From the U.S. and from Australia, the Australian Foreign Minister John Howard, and also U.S. Senator Tom Harkin, also gave a very, very important speech, encouraged people, East Timorese, especially to look forward towards the future, how to develop East Timor and how to make East Timor a democratic country. Also, there is a group of East Timorese, including Sunana Kusmaun and Ramos Horta, visit the cemetery and laid flowers to remember those who were killed in the unforgettable massacre of November 12, 1991. So there are lots of activities around Dili. Last night, people burned candles everywhere in Dili to remember those who were killed in the eve of the historic referendum.
Constancio Pinto, this is Juan Gonzalez. I wanted to ask you, we've been hearing the reports about the attacks coming across the border from West Timor by these right-wing militias. It's been an exhilarating but difficult year for you, but have these attacks, are they having any kind of impact on your ability to reconstruct, to begin the reconstruction of your country?
Well, I think, yes, there is impact on the people on the border, especially in Maliana, Swai, but not really in Dili, where I am, and in the eastern part of the country. Yes, we heard a lot of reports from there that militia have infiltrated. There are also reports saying that the militia have now reached the central areas, Same, Ainaro, and Romelao. But people feel they just ignore that they are coming. But I'm not saying that yes, there's no people that that not everyone thinks that they're safe. Because especially the peacekeeping troops are not working alongside with the volunteers, and also because of the lack of knowledge of the territory, it's very difficult for the peacekeeping troops to track down all the militias. So they are now talking about having the volunteer the East Timorese armed forces to control the borders, because they are the ones who know that the land, they can easily track down all the militias. But in Dili, things seem quite calm.
We understand that there's controversy around, I think it was a Newsweek magazine quote of Sunana Kusmaun saying that if the Contras or the Indonesian militias continue, that the Falantil, the Timorese soldiers, will attack them in West Timor. You've just come from the meetings of your party, the CNRT, the umbrella of resistance groups. Did Sunana say this, and what do you think about it?
No, I think that people misquoted this thing, because maybe there are rumors that people just, their reports based on rumors. Because here, the UN is the only legal entity in this country. It's running the country. It has all this judicial, political, and executive power. So we are careful about it, the involvement of volunteer in this matter. We want to, the volunteer has involved in this thing, but there has to be some kind of an agreement which legalizes whatever the volunteer involvement. Otherwise, it would be a disaster for us.
We're talking to Constancio Pinto. I saw Constancio last in East Timor. the eve of the massacre, November of 1991, when he told us that this procession would be taking place. He was in hiding at that time. We met in a secret place. I was there with journalist and activist Alan Nairn. The next day, the Indonesian military gunned down this procession, killing more than 250 people. Alan Nairn now joins us on the line from Asia, where he is now. And though we were banned, Alan and I, from returning to Indonesia, he has gotten back in to East Timor last year during the vote and was there. Alan, what are your thoughts today?
Well, one thought is that when Clinton was speaking recently at the Democratic Convention, they should have had a video screen behind him, and projected on the screen should have been a scene from the massacre at the church in Swai. That was the massacre last September where the military and police and militias went in and shot down the priests and gang raped the female refugees and slaughtered them with machetes and rifles and then burned their bodies in front of the church, because that military militia rampage after the independence vote last year really is on Clinton's head, because he could have stopped it. Habibie, the president of Indonesia at the time, had been brought to allowing the referendum in large part by pressure in the form of cutbacks in U.S. Military assistance, pressure that was brought by grassroots activists. But at the time of the Timor vote, the U.S. was still, to an important extent, propping up the military, weapons, ammunition, police, intelligence training, etc. It was clear what was happening. The militias were doing attacks, the military was doing attacks throughout the months prior to the vote. In April of 99, days after the massacre at the Likisaa Church, where the police blue mob backed up militiamen with machetes who went in and slaughtered refugees in the rectory, Admiral Blair, Dennis Blair, the chief of U.S. Pacific Forces, sat down with General Wiranto, the Indonesian commander, and gave him a tacit green light to proceed. He praised him. He offered him new U.S. aid, even invited him to his house. And Wiranto took that, not unreasonably, as a mandate. The military, the Indonesian military, then proceeded. The Monday after the announcement of the result that the Timorese had voted for freedom, they started to burn down Dili. They burned down most of it within 24 hours. The Air Force, the Navy, the Marine, the police were all brought in to sweep people from their houses. They actually abducted nearly half the population. And the terror was in full swing. It was only 5 days later that Clinton finally cut off U.S. military aid. But by then, East Timor was largely destroyed.
Well, Alan, the former dictator of Indonesia is about to go on trial this week. And what is your sense whether the changes and the democracy movement in Indonesia has had any impact on the Indonesian military and its treatment of both the nationality still oppressed within Indonesia as well as its relationship to East Timor?
Well, that's one of the key questions. When the Timorese won, it was this epic victory. It inspired a lot of people. One of the goals of the military in staging the militia rampage in Timor, well, one was revenge, and they certainly got revenge, but another one was to intimidate Indonesians, to send a message to intimidate Indonesian activists. That didn't work. And in the months following the Timor rampage of September, within Indonesia, the military was really forced into political retreat by Indonesian activists. There was a growing anti-military movement, and there were changes, especially in Jakarta. There were investigations, open criticism of the military, although the repression never really stopped in the countryside. But recently, in the past 1-2 months, the military has been making a political comeback. They just got legal protection for themselves against prosecution written into the Constitution. They just institutionalized their role in the parliament. A recent general, General Bambang Susilo Yudhoyono, is now in effect administering the entire government in the civilian administration of Gus Dur. And they've been getting increasingly open support from the U.S. executive branch, particularly the Pentagon. The U.S. recently staged a military exercise involving mock landings on Indonesian islands with the U.S. give so-called anti-terrorist training to the Indonesian military. They're trying to give C-130 spare parts. And this has really heartened the Indonesian military. They recently have been making big displays of it. They ran a photo in the papers of an Indonesian general posing in a U.S. tank a couple weeks ago. Recently, at the Siabu target range, the public display of the U.S. supplied...
it's getting a little difficult to understand you.
...targets on the ground.
Alan, it's getting a little difficult to understand you. Alan, speaking to us from Asia. Go ahead.
I'll try to speak a little louder.
If you can, if you moved, it's very difficult now. So if you moved, you should move back to where you were.
Okay,
go ahead.
One big result of this, I think this has been a big factor.
Alan, I think we're going to call you back because now your voice is breaking up too much. So we will come back to you.
Okay.
Alan Nairn speaking to us. About the situation in Indonesia and East Timor. We will see now if Constancio Pinto is still on the line with us. Constancio, are you there?
Yes.
Can you describe the events? Amazing. Here is Constancio in East Timor, Dili, a very clear line, although we do have to say the phone system there is extremely rough. Their cell phones only operate within a small area of one antenna that has been put up, or satellite that has been put up by the Australians. What has been the events of today since the ceremony at the Santa Cruz massacre? We just pulled you out of a large celebration. It's now your time, about 9:40 at night on the day of the first anniversary of the independence vote.
People actually today, they celebrate. We celebrate the 30th of the first anniversary of a referendum. So there are two reactions here. One is to remember the loved ones who were killed in 1991, the Santa Cruz massacre, and those who were killed during the referendum or after the referendum. And also, people also celebrate happiness the day of the freedom of East Timor, which is the 30th of August. So now people try to think about, you know, what's going to happen in the future, how the leaders are going to handle this country, a country that has totally destroyed by the Indonesians, a country which is totally dependent on the foreign aid. So there's a lot of discussion about it. So people celebrate, they are happy, but at the same time worry about the future, the stability and the economic stability and security in East Timor. So this is something that I heard a lot from the people, from the young generation and the old generation and so on.
Constancio Pinto, we are rejoined by Alan Nairn, and we wanted to ask Alan a question as he talks about the situation in Indonesia. There is a U.S. permanent resident, Jafar Siddiq Hamzah, who we've talked about before on Democracy Now! Several weeks ago, he disappeared. He is Achenese from West Sumatra, from western part of Indonesia. Can you tell us about his situation, Alan?
Jafar, a bit more than 3 weeks ago, just vanished off the streets of Medan. He had been calling his home every 2 hours to check in, and then he was gone. I think it was a very professional job, whoever did it, but they did make some mistakes, and you know, there may be some possibilities for finding out exactly what happened. This takes place in the context of really extensive disappearances in Aceh. The military and the police especially are sweeping through the rural villages. They're pulling people off of buses and out of the police chief recently declared that there was an activist he wanted to catch, and he would capture him dead or alive. And now Jafar disappears. And I think there's something that the military should understand about this case. If they did take Jafar, I think they made a major blunder, because it's going to hurt them internationally in more ways than they realized. But even if they didn't take him, most people will assume they did. So I think it's actually in their interest now, in terms of political damage control, to release him if he's still alive. If they kill him now, or if they've already killed him, then they're in very big trouble, because the issue is only going to grow. And even
say that again. If they were Alan, we're losing you again. If they did kill him, what?
Well, they're in very big political trouble. The issue will only grow.
Say that again.
Because the issue is only going to grow if that happened. But even then, the quiet things a bit if they misbehave.
We can't. You are just losing you, Alan. We're just having a hard time hearing you. One more.
I'll try again. I'm saying that even if they did kill him, at least by the person's body, it might quiet him somewhat. If somebody else took Jafar, then I think the military's only political hope is to tell the world exactly what they know and hope that it's still.
If people are having trouble hearing,
they're smart.
If people are having trouble, Alan, he's saying if he was killed, that the Indonesian military should produce his body and explain what happened. Alan, I want to.
I think if the military is smart, they'll drop their current approach to this and get in touch with Jafar's friends and try to work something out. This case is really going to hurt them.
That the case is going to grow, and that the Indonesian military should get in touch with Jafar's friends and family and work something out. People have been calling the State Department in this country demanding an accounting of Jafar Sadiq Hamzah, who is the Indonesian human rights lawyer from Aceh, who returned. He's a permanent resident in New York, who returned and disappeared several weeks ago. Well, that does it for this remembrance today, this look ahead and this assessment of what is happening today, both in East Timor and Indonesia. Alan Nairn has been our guest, journalist and activist who is in Asia. Constancio Pinto, underground leader for many years in East Timor. He was forced to leave the country after the Santa Cruz massacre as the Indonesian military waged a nationwide manhunt for him, threatened to kill him, had already captured and tortured him in the past. Now the East Timorese have to rebuild their country as they build towards independence on this first anniversary of the vote for freedom in East Timor. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, we go south to Colombia, where President Clinton is going today to Cartagena and find out about the situation there as he brings more than $1 billion in aid. Stay with us.
Ay, mi ley, y el hombre borracho.
Palo con él.
Que no se quiere componer.
Palo con él.
Ay, que no sé qué voy a hacer.
Palo con él.
Que no se puede componer.
Palo con él.
Que ya mi ley. Que ya mi ley. Que ya mi ley ya está borracho.
Palo con él.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Clinton today becomes the first president in 11 years to visit Colombia. He's making a brief stop off in Cartagena to symbolically deliver the $1.3 billion U.S. aid package to President Pastrana to fight the so-called war on drugs. Against the wishes of human rights activists in Colombia and the U.S., Clinton signed a waiver last week that allows the aid money to be delivered despite Colombia's failure to meet six conditions on the aid package designed to protect human rights. The bulk of the $1.3 billion U.S. aid package is earmarked for the Colombian military. This comes as the peace process between the Colombian government and rebel groups is at a standstill. Juan, you did a piece for the New York Daily News today on Colombia. That's the top story on the Common Dreams website.
Yes, well, actually, it was yesterday that the piece came out. But yes, and basically, I was just recapping in that. In that column, both the impact of what that aid will be on not just Colombia, but all the countries of the region, as well as the reaction of many in the Colombian community here in the United States, as there's a growing peace movement among Colombians in this country trying to prevent the impact of the aid. And we have to put this aid in context. $1.3 billion, that is more aid than the United States is giving to all of the rest of Latin America together. To give you a sense of the impact this is going to have on that country, the total national budget of Colombia is only about $30 billion. So this is an enormous, this is in essence the United States through cash donations and through the helicopters it is giving to Colombia, being in essence taking over a lot of the Colombian military's source of funding.
This at a time as the violence increases. This past Sunday, 20 people killed in two separate massacres attributed by news reports to paramilitaries. 10 people killed execution style in Cienaga, and 10 men were taken from a pool hall and shot point blank, allegedly for being sympathizers of rebels. We're joined by Mario Murillo, who has just returned from Colombia. He's a longtime producer at Pacifica Station WBAI, and for years has produced and hosted the national weekly news magazine Our Americas. Welcome to Democracy Now, Mario.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be here. Hi, Juan.
Mario, tell us in your visit, what were some of the things that you discovered that have been developing in Colombia now in the last few months?
Well, I think the overall feeling right now is that, first of all, the situation is bound to get worse. Right now in the New York Times today, we see the reports of President Clinton giving a 7-minute address last night to national television in Colombia, talking about how they're here to help. We're neighbors and friends. We're not here to intervene in any way. President Pastrana, meanwhile, was also turning it around and saying, well, this Plan Colombia will only work if the United States takes a serious effort at looking at not only eradication, but consumption at home. So they're painting it really nicely. But the fact of the matter is that, as you pointed out, that $1.3 billion in assistance, almost 82% of that is going directly towards the military. So the bulk of that aid, while they try to say it's a social, economic assistance package that's also going to help the justice system and all the other social components of Colombian society, the bulk of it is military. And the majority of the people that I've spoken with, and I should point out that President Clinton is going to Cartagena, and he indicated last week when I was still there, he was saying, how I want to see the true face of Colombia right now, and that's why I want to go there. I don't want to be interfered with. First of all, they're cleaning the streets like you wouldn't believe in Cartagena to the tune of $7.5 million. So that's the true face that they're going to see. But if he really wanted to see the true face of Colombia, he wouldn't go to Cartagena only. He would probably take a trip to Barranca, where the civilian population has been under siege by paramilitaries allied with the Colombian armed forces. He would go down to San Jose del Guaviare, for example, where I spent about a week there earlier this month, where I was speaking with, and this is the part of the country where the United States and the Colombian government started this so-called fumigation eradication program in 1993 through 1997. That was the focus of that eradication program. And I talked to dozens of people there who were saying, well, what they're going to do now with this Plan Colombia, which is in another part of the south of Colombia, they have already tried here and it hasn't worked.
You say Plan Colombia. That isn't, I think, a common term for people in the United States.
Well, Plan Colombia is basically like the Marshall Plan of President Pastrana. He's been pushing this as the way of rebuilding the country after 40 years of civil war, after internal conflict that has cost thousands and thousands of lives. And basically the idea is that, okay, well, Colombia has got a serious problem, but it cannot solve it by itself, and it has to incorporate the international community in one way or another. So the idea is the budget for the Plan Colombia is about $7.5 billion. And the idea is that, okay, we're going to get pledges from Washington, pledges from Europe, and then Colombia is going to match those pledges to try to deal with social development, alternative crop programs in the south. Again, as I said, strengthening the institutions of government, et cetera. But so that's more or less what the idea of the Plan Colombia is. And again, they're counting on Europe and the United States. Needless to say, the United States component is primarily military, whereas Europe is mostly in the social area. And the idea is to eradicate coca for example, the plan specifies that within the next 5 years, they're going to be able to get rid of 50% of all coca cultivations in the country, which is practically impossible by all analyses that we've looked at. Also, the way to strengthen democracy is to improve social programs in the countryside, et cetera, et cetera. But again, the focus that most people are talking about now is the United States component of that Plan Colombia, which is, as Juan just pointed out, and as many critics have pointed out, is primarily a military program that is focused on, again, combating the southern the stronghold of the guerrillas in the southern part of the country, which is, of course, a strong area of coca cultivation.
Well, Mario, in terms of the coca cultivation, one of the things I think that has not gotten much attention is how this eradication program is going to create environmental problems. Brazil, for instance, has been protesting what the impact of massive spraying is going to do on the Amazon because of this. It's in the southern area of Colombia where a lot of the spraying will occur. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the fact that they call it a triple deforestation. Three levels of deforestation. The first level, of course, is the fact that the campesinos, the poor peasants in that part of the country, are forced to cultivate coca because they have no other alternatives. I spoke to a number of people down there in San Jose who were talking about how they had no other options. They tried to grow yuca, they tried to grow bananas, and they basically had no other options but to grow the coca. So that's the first. Obviously, they go into the jungle, they knock out a bunch of forests, and they start growing coca. The second level of that deforestation is the fumigations, the eradication that comes, again, through the United States, primarily through the United States, that devastates the local environment, poisons the environment. And then finally, the third level is once these major crop cultivations are completely eradicated or completely poisoned, these campesinos are forced to knock down more forests because they're moving further away to another level. And that's basically what's going to happen. This Plan Colombia seems to have not taken that reality into consideration, that this is inevitable that's going to happen. Now, I spoke with I don't know if we have time just to play this one cut. I have a lot of tape, and I hope to put some stuff together for Our Americas and perhaps here for Democracy Now! As well. But I spoke to one person, Pedro Arenas, in San Jose. He's a community activist. He's a former council member in San Jose and an assembly member in El Guaviare, who's now currently running for the mayoralty of San Jose. Needless to say, with major risk because of his positions against the eradication program. In 1997, he was forced to leave the country for about 2 months because of his organizing of the campesino protests against the fumigation. And he was basically talking about how, once again, Plan Colombia, which is focused in Putumayo and other parts of the southern part of Colombia, has already been experimented on in San Jose and in Guaviare, and basically to very negative effects.
El Guaviare ha sido incluso presentado como un ejemplo de erradicación.
He says that El Guaviare has been presented as an example of the eradication program, and it's been used as an example of the effectiveness of the fumigation efforts spearheaded by Washington. It has been said that in the Guaviare province there is no coca right now, and that the fumigations have been successful and that the cultivations have been terminated, which is clearly not the case. The government likes to say that there are no problems here anymore in Guaviare, but that's simply not true. Here, the economy, like in other parts of Colombia, continues to be dependent on these illicit crops. What has happened in recent years? Well, as he says, most of the attention now in Colombia is either in San Vicente del Caguan, which is where the Colombian military demilitarized the area to continue peace talks with the guerrillas of the FARC. And also they're focusing on Putumayo, which is south of San Jose. where they're going to focus on this Plan Colombia. And all the attention is now on those two areas. And as he argues, he says that they're going down there to, you know, the media go down there to this demilitarized zone, and it's like a safari, like a show for them, like a circus, because that's where all the attention is. But the media is not looking at the old Hollywoods, as he points out, like El Guaviare, Miraflores, the former capital of cocaine, of coca. Nobody pays attention to what's happening here. And basically, the fact of the matter is that the poverty, the displacement, the exclusion, the misery of the people continues to be an everyday part of the reality. And I just wanted to add to that, you know, because I mean, he says a lot more. When you talk to people, when you talk to young people, especially in that part of the country, they have no options, and they don't think that the Plan Colombia is going to solve their problems. They have two options: one, to get into the guerrilla, or two, get into the paramilitaries, because there, then they're going to have a gun, they're going to have a uniform, they're going to have a salary, and the paramilitaries pay up to 150,000 pesos a week, which is not so much, but considering the money that a regular peasant worker would get in that part of the country, it's a lot of money, and basically that's the only options they have. And again, the government, which always argues and has been arguing lately, that the guerrillas control 60% of the territory or 40% of the territory. The fact of the matter is that the government has always neglected this part of the country, and now they're starting to focus on it, but again, primarily through a military component.
Is there a sense that the U.S. is getting involved in an escalating civil war that the U.S. is fueling?
Well, I think one thing, I mean, this is one of the arguments I've always made, and I think a lot of people down there argue. In fact, Pedro Arenas, in the other cut, which we don't have time to listen to, he says that this is nothing new, that in the United States they talk about a new intervention or as if it's something that's happening in the future, but it's been going on for years. If we can talk about Kennedy and then Johnson escalating the war in Vietnam, well, we can talk about Kennedy and Johnson escalating the war in Colombia. And I think the same thing, and now you're seeing people paying attention to it, but the fact of the matter is that the military presence of the United States in Colombia has always been there. The training, the manipulation of the internal conflict has always been there as part of the United States. Now it's just more pronounced.
And of course, one of the arguments that you hear from the Clinton administration is that the human rights violations of the Colombian army have gone down. It used to be that the army was accused of about over 50% of all the human rights violations. Now it's down to a few percent. But the problem is that the paramilitaries, they've escalated to almost 78% of all of the human rights violations. And we've seen this situation before. We saw it in Haiti with the FRAP. We saw it in Salvador with Roberto Dobuzan's right-wing squads. And we saw it in Timor with the civilians. When the military wants to get the heat off of itself, a repressive military, it just spawns unofficial right-wing groups that do the killing, the dirty war for them.
Mm-hmm. And while there is some lip service carried out against the paramilitaries, the attention constantly is on the FARC. The attention of all the violence and all the actions that are being carried out against the civilian population, if you look at El Tiempo or El Espectador, the major dailies, every day you'll have a huge headline of an attack on a police base or something in by the FARC or by the guerrillas, and then you'll have a very small headline, four campesinos massacred by the AUC, the paramilitary group. And that's the constant drumbeat that we hear over and over again. The paramilitaries are a problem, but the guerrillas are the serious problem in Colombia.
And that's the refrain of the press. Well, I want to thank you very much, Mario Murillo, for joining us. And we really look forward to your documentary and playing it also on Democracy Now!, what is happening in Colombia today. Mario Murillo is a professor at Hofstra University in Long Island, New York, a professor of communications, and a longtime producer at Pacifica Station WBAI and the national radio program Our Americas. That does it for the show. If you'd like to email us, please do at democracy@pacifica.org. Check out our website with all the latest news. It links to the documentary on Timor, as well as lots of work on Colombia. That's www.democracynow.org. www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill, Matthew Finch, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.
important lesson, I suppose, is that politics never